Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 12th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jill Whitman, and she will be speaking on Northwest geology and natural hazards. Let's listen in.
Take that opportunity to say again that I'm Jill Whitman. I'm going to talk today about some of the, just briefly, sort of the bigger geologic picture here, and then talk about some of the hazards, the natural hazards that we encounter living in this area. For those of you who were here yesterday, the first bit is going to be sort of a brief summary of some of what we talked about, and then moving into talking about some other things. In order to really explain why we live in an area that has natural hazards associated with it, we need to understand something about the geologic setting. And to do that, I start by just talking a little bit about plate tectonics, and then from there I'll go in to talk about some of the hazards, or some of the geologic features and then the hazards associated with them, and sort of come back and talk about what that actually means in terms of our lives. I talked about plate tectonics yesterday and talked about it as being this theory that emerged in the 1960s. It's a very convenient theory right now for geologists to use to explain much of what we see in the Earth. Basically, what the theory says is the surface of the Earth is made up of plates or pieces that are about 60 miles thick, and these pieces move around on the surface of the Earth independently of one another. Some places they're moving apart from one another, some places they're moving towards each other, and other places they're sliding by each other. And geologically, the plates are great, but we're really most concerned in terms of looking at geologic events at where these plates meet. And we'll be coming back and looking at that today. The kind of plate boundaries, well, here, this is a cross-section of the Earth that helps us to visualize some of these different types of plate boundaries. The places where the plates are moving apart, where we have then molten material coming up from deeper in the Earth, making it to the surface and creating new crusts in our ocean basins. Places where the plates are coming together, we're destroying old crust, usually it's old oceanic crust. And our third type of plate boundary is one where the plates slide past one another. And an example would be in this stretch where these two plates are moving apart, but if we draw a line parallel to the direction they're moving, we realize that the plates are simply sliding past one another at that point. We name these different types of plate boundaries where they move apart, or divergent plate boundaries where they come together, or convergent plate boundaries. And then we have lateral plate boundaries or transform faults there. We're most interested here, in this region where we live, in convergent plate boundaries, places where the two plates are coming together. There are a variety of types of these. We see that in general they have some amount of volcanism associated with them, far more volcanism associated with where two oceanic crust plates come together, or where an oceanic crust and a continental crust plate come together, where two continental masses meet each other, we get less volcanism and a lot more hefty deformation than we see in the other two examples. We can look at the distribution of these types of plate boundaries when we look at a map like this, a map that shows us what the surface of the Earth would look like by one artist's rendition if we drained the ocean basins. And these divergent plate boundaries are found in the oceans, running through the middle of the Atlantic and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, a system that's sort of Y-shaped here, of three ridges in the Indian Ocean, and running up through the Pacific Ocean here at the East Pacific Rise. One little other segment of ridge is one that we find up here, actually off the coast of the northwestern part of the United States, and one that, while a very small ridge system, has lots of relevance for us. As I mentioned, things happen at these plate boundaries, and another way to visualize the plate boundaries is to, for example, plot out the distribution of earthquakes on the surface of the Earth. And we find that in general, they coincide with these plate boundaries that we've seen. We saw our ridge systems outlined by them. Our convergent plate boundaries are represented by the very deep parts of the oceans where we have trenches, and those are also areas of very high earthquake activity as well. We see that up here in this region, we have earthquakes associated with this ridge system, and then a band of earthquakes associated with the Rockies. As someone asked yesterday, that's sort of the one thing that you really can't do very well with plate tectonics, but we do also have earthquakes here associated with the northwestern part of North America. Not as great a frequency as some other areas, and so they don't plot out on this map. One of the other things that happens at certain plate boundaries, particularly at our convergent plate boundaries, is volcanism. Volcanism actually at the surface. This volcanism is associated with the ridges, but it's beneath the surface and doesn't plot out, in fact, as what this map shows of active volcanoes. But we can see all around the Pacific, we have this ring of volcanism, often referred to as the ring of fire around the Pacific. Those are associated with our convergent plate boundaries. And we're going to be focusing in particular in this area, but you can see that it's certainly not this string of volcanoes that we know here is not unique to this area. The Aleutian Islands are the result of similar processes down through Japan, the Philippines, the Mariana Islands, and so on, all around the Pacific. If we look at this, and hopefully you can kind of look at this picture and not the other one, because I'm going to be turning the overhead off again. It doesn't work very well with that slide, though, does it? Get one, though? Back out to before there. Okay, so what we have here is a map of the western part of North America showing us the plate on which we all live, which is the North American plate, and its interaction with other plates and the boundaries that result. We have a very small plate here being generated at this ridge system, the Juan de Fuca plate, very large plate out here occupying the Pacific Ocean, and another smaller plate, which is down in this region. We talked some about how this is a boundary. It's a lateral boundary or a transform boundary. Obviously, one that we know is associated with earthquake activity, since California frequently experiences that. But we have a convergent plate boundary then that runs down here between the Juan de Fuca plate and the North American plate. And that's illustrated here then in that cross section. Well, what does that mean for us? Well, we live on this ring of fire. And it means that there are various natural hazards in living in this sort of an area. Oftentimes they become called disasters. They're only disasters if people live there and experience disastrous consequences. Really what they are hazards that we encounter in this area. And basically, the two major natural hazards that exist in this area are that of volcanism and of earthquakes. And we'll talk about these and we'll look at how the activity of these has been over the last few thousand years in this region and talk about what that then means in terms of the future. Last summer, obviously, this area was reminded of another sort of natural hazard which can occur, that of the fires, and that isn't part of what I was going to talk about today, since that isn't geologically related. But again, if we back up for just a moment and look at this, what we have is a situation very similar to this, where we have an oceanic plate, the Juan de Fuca plate, subducting beneath the continent of North America. Well, why do we have volcanoes in this area? Well, what we do in a subduction zone is take a plate which has been at the surface and push it back down, or perhaps pull it back down into the interior of the Earth. What happens? Well, at some level, it becomes completely molten again, or the state which we find down here in the asthenosphere, which is nearly completely molten. As this plate is subducted, however, before we get to that depth, we get melting beginning to occur. And a lot of that is due to the presence of sediments here, which are on the seafloor, carried along on this plate, which contain a large amount of water. That presence of water causes this material to melt at these shallower depths. The molten material is lighter, and it rises to the surface, and we have volcanism. Now, volcanism takes many forms on the surface of the Earth, and we unfortunately don't very often see pictures of the dramatic volcanism that occurs at this type of a plate boundary. Mostly that's because it is a very explosive type of volcanism, and by the time the media gets out there to take the pictures of it, often the Big Bang is over. The kind of volcanism that we're all much more familiar with seeing in news footage is that of, say, Hawaii, which is a much more gentle type of volcanism. We aren't going to see much of that type of volcanism here in this area today. The chemistry of the type of molten material coming to the surface is such that we have a much greater explosive volcanism. In Hawaii, the chemistry of the rocks being formed there is such that it flows out much more gently, and I'm sure most of you have seen footage that shows people basically walking up to lava flows. Obviously, Mount St. Helens showed us that we don't just walk up to that kind of an eruption. Mount St. Helens is our recent reminder of this type of volcanism in this area. This is a picture taken prior to 1980 of Mount St. Helens. It was a spectacular example of the type of volcano which forms in this area. They form through fairly explosive eruptions, where we get a layering of material which forms very steep-sided volcanoes. And we see this shape here, the very steep sides, such as we also see in Japan and Mount Fujiyama. In contrast, if we look in Hawaii, the kinds of volcanism that exists there produce volcanoes which have very gently sloping sides because the material flows out very gently over great distances. Most of this cone of Mount St. Helens was built over the last 40,000 years. The Cascades, as we know them today, the volcanoes which we see today, all are generally about 2 million years or less in age. They're built on an ancestral range of the Cascades that started about 12 million years ago, but this was a very young member of the Cascade range. It had been fairly actively studied because early studies of the volcano had revealed that it had been fairly active. It appeared to be one of the more active ones. It had undergone a major eruptive phase in the first half of the 19th century. That had been documented by visitors from the East and European visitors. And by the end of the 1970s, geologists from the U.S. Geological Survey had determined that this was probably the most active volcano in the Cascade Range. And in fact, they made a statement that Mount St. Helens has been more active and more explosive during the last 4,500 years than any other volcano in the conterminous United States, so the lower 48 states. And they made the prediction that it was the volcano most likely to erupt before the end of the century. This was based on field studies of the deposits from this volcano and evaluating where it was in its evolution of growth compared to some of the other volcanoes. Well, that was published in 1978 by two geologists. And starting in the spring of 1980, activity began occurring at Mount St. Helens. A lot of earthquakes, and earthquakes concentrated right under the cone, suggested to geologists that this meant that there was something moving at depth beneath the volcano. If we think of what generates an earthquake, we have to have something which moves fairly abruptly and releases its energy as it moves. And so what geologists believe was happening was that the rock was being pushed apart as molten material made its way up. And in fact, during the spring of 1980, this side of the volcano grew outward in a bulge, suggesting something from below was applying pressure, causing it to expand, and there were a few puffs of ash out of the top of the volcano, so that actually prior to the major eruption in May, it was kind of a gray-looking cone and no longer as white as this because of the ash. But as most of us in this room probably remember, on May 18th in 1980, the volcano went in a very big way. There were some people who were fortunate enough to be in locations outside the area where they would have been killed, but fortuitously looking at the volcano at the right time and getting some pretty spectacular pictures. And when I talk later on this week about Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier in more detail, talk about the sequence of events associated with this eruption, but one of the things that happened was basically the north side of the volcano blew off, releasing a huge pressurized cloud of gas and ash, and this is what we see this explosion occurring. That which really was caught on any footage of that could be shown in video was the eruption of ash upward in a plume for about 12 hours, and that's what we see here, and that was really all that the news media was able to get in and show footage of. There are still photographs of that major explosion out the side. It's believed that somewhere on the order of a third of a cubic kilometer of material came out of the volcano, and much of it came out locally, although people all the way across the United States were aware of the ash as it came out and traveled eastward across the United States. Scientists, in trying to estimate the power of this explosion, estimated it at about equivalent to 27,000 Hiroshima bombs, a big blast that had occurred. There have been a series of events which have continued since that time, and a small dome has built itself again within the crater here, and geologists believe that it will continue its dome building for some many thousands of years to come. Most of the activity that produced that little dome actually occurred in the first 5 years after the 1980 eruption, and it's been relatively quiet since then. One of the other things you can see in this photograph is sort of all the devastation this side of the volcano. If you remember in the pre-1980 picture, lots of vegetation there. How many of you have ever been down to see Mount St. Helens? It's a pretty awesome experience, isn't it?
Vibrant.
Did you?
All the way years ago.
Up to from the southeast.
Yeah, and then just look in, and you really can see the enormousness. I had no idea. You know, you can see it on the picture, but
right.
When you're up there, it's just incredible. It's just incredible.
And was there snow on it, or were you able to get to the top without snow?
No snow. Well, because, I'm not in that good shape, but if you're in half a decent shape, it's 4.5 miles, 4,500 elevation gain.
Right, and the last 1,000 feet is all in loose pumice.
Right, very hard to get up. Very slow.
That's what I've heard.
It takes a long time to get up.
It's like slogging through a really muddy beach.
Do you know the date of the Lassen earthquake? Mount Lassen?
The Lassen earthquake or the mud flow that was?
Well, I just remember that it was in the 50s, 40s, the late 40s that we drove up there, and there was still a lot of devastation. So it must have been,
teens. Hang on just a sec. A view of Crater Lake. Crater Lake did the same thing as Mount St. Helens, but in a much bigger way, having released probably as much as 10 cubic miles of material. Huge eruption about 6,600 years ago. The deposits from this can be seen over a much more extensive area than that from Mount St. Helens. About 30 times the size of Mount St. Helens. Mount Lassen, as the view of Mount Lassen taken from what is now a parking lot looking up at the summit, but in 1914, 1915 was when Mount Lassen had some eruptions. Now, not eruptions in the same explosive sense as the Mount St. Helens one of 80 or the one from the Crater Lake area, but what happened here was a huge mud flow was produced. Enough heating at the summit by material moving up toward the summit and the release of hot gas that it melted the material here. It melted the ice and that picked up debris and carried it down with it. And in fact, this parking lot is in an area that was completely devastated by that mud flow.
Well, there was still, as I recall, when we were up there, a lot of areas closed. And that would have been in the late 40s.
Right.
So that took a long time
to do it. Yeah, and the vegetation is much smaller. I mean, this whole, it sort of came down this area, and you can see that the growth back has been fairly slow. This picture was taken about 5 years ago, so. Now, one of the other volcanoes that many of us are familiar with is Mount Rainier, and Mount Rainier is significantly taller than most of the other Cascade volcanoes, and one of the things that means is that it has a tremendous amount of snow and ice on it. Mount Rainier is about 2 million years old, much older than Mount St. Helens in terms of its evolution, and it's believed to have reached its maximum height about 75,000 years ago. Probably about 2,000 feet higher than it presently is. And the evidence in the geologic record suggests that about 6,000 years ago, it blew its top, and were extensive ash deposits from that and mud flows and avalanches produced. Since that time, it too has built a small dome again, or cone, at the summit, but it hasn't built up anywhere near to the height that it previously had been. But all of this snow and ice on Mount Rainier presents a very, very great risk. Geologists are particularly worried about Mount Rainier experiencing another large explosive eruption. They believe that it's sort of on the downhill side of its growth as a volcano, but there is still a lot of heat associated with Mount Rainier. There are fumaroles near the summit, and periodically steam is released. And that then indicates that there is a threat of melting all of this ice associated with Mount Rainier. And one of the most major mud flows produced by Mount Rainier was not 6,000 years ago when it blew its top, but a few hundred years later when the Osceola mud flow occurred. And the mud flow came down this side of the volcano, sort of off to the northeast, and then flowed down in pre-existing valleys, covering a very, very large area. A lot of work has been done sort of looking at excavations around the valley areas of Mount Rainier. To those of you who are somewhat familiar with the area, there's a valley coming up this way, the Kent Valley lowlands with higher areas on this side, and then beginning to build up toward the foothills. And this is the Puyallup River Valley coming off in this direction, and a number of the valleys that drain from the various glaciers with rivers flowing out of them. And what this map indicates is the amount of risk believed to be associated with future potential mud flows off of Mount Rainier. Basically based on the existing data from previous mud flows. And one can see from this that urban areas that we know today, such as the downtown Tacoma tide flats area, is one which is still within the path of potential mud flows, and all the way up through the Kent Valley as well. Makes for great soil. It's a wonderful texture, sort of silty. It's fairly rich soil, and hence these are the valleys of agriculture that are associated with the Tacoma-Seattle area. As a geologist, I'm really quite embarrassed to admit where I live. I live down right about here. I live about a mile from the Western Washington State Fairgrounds in Puyallup, and about 4 years ago they were doing some major excavations to lay some new utility lines within the fairgrounds, and discovered just wonderful, wonderful geologic record deposits of major mud flows that had come down and filled in that valley. So, it's a beautiful place to live, but Mount Rainier has not had any form of eruption in the past 100 years, and as I said, geologists really don't see that as a risk. On the other hand, we certainly see the potential for mud flows, and the other thing that there is some potential for associated with Mount Rainier as the entire region is that of earthquakes. And if we revisit a map that shows us something of the distribution of earthquakes globally, again, we see them associated with the types of plate boundaries and around this ring of fire, and we certainly see earthquakes associated with this area. And what I wanted to do is to spend a little bit of time talking about sort of this distribution of earthquakes and a little bit about how we measure earthquakes and describe it so that it means something to us when we hear that. We think of earthquakes and how we feel them at the surface, but in fact, earthquakes occur not necessarily at the surface, but with some depth beneath the earth. And this is an example of a convergent plate boundary. And we see that basically those earthquakes occur all the way down to a depth of about 700 kilometers, where we still have a rigid plate that's moving back down into the earth. In order to have an earthquake, we have to have moved some rigid material past some other rigid material. By the time we get down beneath this, remember the plate has basically been remolten back into the interior of the earth. Well, sure, it's awful when there are earthquakes down deep, but we aren't going to feel those. It's the shallower earthquakes we're going to feel at the surface. But it is important to realize that we have a much greater range of depth and hence surface area where we might feel the earthquakes associated with a convergent plate boundary. At a transformed plate boundary, we're just going to get earthquakes along where those two plates are sliding past each other. We're not going to be experiencing them off at depth in various other directions. So, we have earthquakes here. They're associated with a convergent plate boundary. They occur down at depth. How do we go about describing them? Well, we talk about a term that comes up a lot is the term epicenter, which basically means the place on the surface of the earth that the earthquake, the release of the earthquake energy occurred at or beneath. So we might have had an earthquake occur down here, say in one of these green dots. That's the focus of the release of the energy. But from a human point of view, we talk about the epicenter, the point above where that occurred. Now, sometimes the earthquakes occur very close to the surface, and so the focus or the actual point of release of energy is actually very close to the epicenter. And that's pretty true in California when we look at the movement along the San Andreas Fault. Here, though, we tend to see earthquakes perhaps occurring at greater depths and then talking about the point above where that release of energy occurred. We measure earthquakes in two different ways. The way that has been used extensively over the last century is to measure what we call the magnitude of an earthquake. Can you all see that despite the picture behind it here? We use the Richter scale to measure the magnitude of an earthquake, and what we're actually measuring is the amount of energy released from the earthquake. And this can be done using sensitive kinds of devices, seismographs. We've only been able to do it for about the last century because that's when the device was first invented. And we can see that we see various earthquakes of ranges in magnitude. For those of you who live in the Puget Sound area, Christmas Eve of 1989, there was an earthquake associated with Mount Rainier, and that had a magnitude of 4.2. Did you all feel it in silicon?
I was asleep.
Well, you see, one of the other things of living on a mud flow deposit is that it kind of shakes like a bowl full of jelly. So it was felt at my house in Puyallup. Other earthquakes, there are ones that we're all quite familiar with. The San Fernando quake of 71 was a 6.6. was a 7.1. The Alaskan earthquake of 1964 was the largest felt in North America in recorded history at 8.4. The Chilean earthquake of 1960 that produced so much devastation was a 9.5, an absolutely enormous earthquake. We had a 4.5 earthquake in the Puget Sound area, 4.5 in January. Did you feel that?
Yes, definitely.
And that, I'll show you on a map soon where that occurred. Didn't end up here in my table. Now, the other way that we talk about the size of an earthquake is to talk about its intensity. And this is a very subjective way to describe the size of an earthquake or to describe what was felt from an earthquake. And instead of using Arabic numerals like 4.2, Roman numerals are used to describe the size of earthquakes for their intensity. And it's done in a very, very subjective kind of fashion. It's based on what people feel. It's based on the amount of damage which structures experience. And instead of there being a unique number associated with an earthquake, the intensity will vary according to distance from the epicenter and the type of material on which people and structures are located. And I will show you a map in a bit that shows you sort of what an intensity diagram would look like. But just to read you a couple of the descriptions that are used in the ranking for the intensity for the Mercalli scale. An intensity 3 value is that which is felt indoors, hanging objects swing, vibration like the passing of light trucks, durations can be estimated, but people may or may not recognize it as an earthquake. By the time we get up to an intensity 8, the steering of cars is affected, there's damage to masonry, twisting of structures, fall of chimneys, frame houses may be moved off foundations if they're not bolted down, branches may be broken from trees, and cracks may open up in the ground. By the time we get to the maximum intensity, damage is basically total. Large rock masses may be displaced, and the surface of the ground will be greatly distorted so that lines of sight and all are greatly altered. So we have used the Mercalli scale for a lot longer to describe the effects of earthquakes because it didn't rely upon any kind of an instrument to measure it, but upon people's observations and descriptions. And so one of the things we deal with is that if we want to go back and talk about, for example, yesterday someone asked about the New Madrid quakes of 1810 and 1811, we had no way to measure those quakes. We simply had descriptions of the intensity of what was felt, and so people have tried to then correlate from what we know in the present century back to make an estimate of what the magnitude of those would have been like. And this next table gives us a means of trying to make some comparison between what we see are the magnitudes of earthquakes using the Richter scale and the intensities of earthquakes and described using the Mercalli scale. And again, this sort of gives you sort of a breakdown of sort of the variations and descriptions. Using this kind of comparison, they then think that the New Madrid quake was up in this category based on the observations and descriptions historically from the record. One of the other important things that this table shows is how the greater the size of the earthquake in terms of its magnitude, how much less the frequency is for an earthquake of that size. So we have lots and lots and lots of little tiny earthquakes that occur all the time globally every year. But it's rare to have very, very large earthquakes. Thank goodness, right? I mean, we're glad in retrospect. Okay, well now what I want to do is look at the earthquake distribution in this area, and I'm just going to move ahead so that I have a black screen here for that. And to look again, to remind us then again, sort of geologically, what the structure is here, we have converging plates in the subduction zone. And if we look then at the distribution of earthquakes in a cross section from west to east, basically across the Olympic Peninsula, Seattle, and over into eastern part of Washington, we see that we have earthquakes that sort of outline this descending plate, the oceanic plate. And we also have shallower earthquakes here in the overlying plate, presumably reflecting some of sort of the tension and compression that this part of the crust experiences as this plate is thrust down. In addition, some earthquakes associated with the Cascade Range, and again, that's probably related to the kind of underground movement of molten magma. If we want to look at this in map view for this region, we see basically our earthquakes distributed, outlining our plate boundaries. We had a ridge system offset by transform faults out here, and we have a convergent plate boundary here, and so we have earthquakes here. We have an interesting convergent plate boundary in terms of our earthquake history. The frequency of earthquakes in this area is less than other similar geologic settings. We are in a very analogous setting to that of Chile or to for the Alaskan earthquake of 64, and yet we don't have earthquakes of the same frequency. And geologists are still struggling to interpret what that means. We have a very tiny little plate here, the Juan de Fuca plate, which is being subducted under North America. And currently people believe that that small plate is simply not being thrust as steeply beneath North America. It's not as old a crust, so it's not cooled and not as rigid, and so it's not producing earthquakes as often as the other plates which are being subducted in similar settings. On the other hand, we certainly have had our share of earthquakes in this area, and if we focus in a little bit more in the Puget Sound region, this is a map which shows the distribution of earthquakes around Puget Sound, basically from the early 1800s to the present. These dots are sized according to the maximum intensity associated with that earthquake. So these aren't magnitudes, this isn't the Richter scale, this is intensity here. And we see that there were a couple of fairly large ones, 1949, 1965. Anybody here live in the Puget Sound region for either of those dates? Well, there were two fairly large ones. In 1965, it was a 6.5 magnitude earthquake, thanks. And it occurred in April, six people died, chimneys fell, roofs collapsed, two beer tanks at the Rainier Brewery were smashed. And people felt it throughout much of Washington and then down into Oregon and Idaho and Montana and up into BC. In 1949, the earthquake had been slightly larger. It was a 7.1. The epicenter of it was down here close to Olympia, whereas the 65 quake was sort of up in the area of where SeaTac Airport is. Eight were killed in that earthquake, and again, it was felt over much of the same region. Both of these earthquakes occurred in April. And not this past April, but a year ago, there was sort of a big spread in the Seattle newspaper over how there's this threat of April earthquakes in the Puget Sound region. We didn't have one that April. Geologists... No, it was at the very end of March, I believe. I think Good Friday was at the end of March that year. Yeah, Good Friday. Geologists, though, have been very puzzled over this lesser frequency of earthquakes in this region, and have spent some time studying the geologic record to see if there's evidence of larger earthquakes associated with this subduction zone, because as I said, we are in a very analogous setting to that of Chile, and as you saw, they had an earthquake that was over a 9. This area hasn't experienced one in terms of people's written history, But on the other hand, a geologist who actually came to the Seattle area working for the U.S. Geological Survey got interested in going out and looking in the coastal region of Washington to see if there was any evidence there that would suggest that the coast had moved up or down very rapidly. And that, he believed, would have been associated with a very large earthquake, which would result in a significant amount of land displacement. Many of you may remember the earthquake from 1985 from Mexico City. Geologists had somewhat fortuitously gone out and installed a whole network of seismographs and made a lot of measurements in that area just prior to when the earthquake occurred. It was very well studied, and one of the things they observed was they could go to the coastal region and see great areas of the coast that had been uplifted in association with that earthquake. Organisms that had lived below sea level were now up above sea level, stranded, and so on. And so this scientist who did the study in this area, named Brian Atwater, looked out in the coastal region and discovered that there was evidence out there of times in which the coastal region had been very rapidly buried, subsided almost instantaneously. And he looked at not only sort of the geologic record, but in combination with the buried biologic material that was there, found vegetation that had been at the surface had all of a sudden been submerged and covered with a layer of sand, and then obviously it had shallowed gradually again as more and more sediments were deposited. And he has made a very extensive study and mapped out areas where this large movement of the land occurred, been able to put some dates using radiocarbon techniques on this rapid movement, and decided that the last big earthquake, perhaps analogous to the Alaskan one, had occurred about 300 years ago. Looking back in the record before that, there seemed to be a frequency of about every 500 years. Well, this obviously got lots and lots of people talking about it, and well, if we do the math there and we say that it will occur on this frequency of every 500 years, oh, then we have 100 years, a couple hundred years to go and not to worry. But as we all know, frequency is sort of an average of the time between events, and it's not necessarily fixed in fact. Well, where do we live? Well, we live in this area of earthquakes. Do we expend much effort and energy and money on preparing for these earthquakes? California spends $1.5 million a year on earthquake preparedness. Does anybody know what the state of Washington spends? $100,000 a year. Our kids in this state are not particularly trained as to what they would do in response to an earthquake. You know what you do in response to an earthquake?
Duck and cover. I taught in California. Duck and cover.
That's right.
Little kids.
Not only cover yourself, but what's the other thing you have to do once you cover yourself? Hold on to whatever it is that's above you. That's right. There's a wonderful, wonderful poster. I mean, wonderful in that fortunately the earthquake occurred before school was in session in Mexico City. But it shows desks from inside a school in Mexico City, where the floor above them has collapsed down onto them and they're supported on the tops of all these desks. So if in fact somebody had been in the building and had ducked and covered under these desks, they would have been safe because of this structure above them. The earthquake that we had in January of this year occurred with its epicenter very, very close to this one. It was offshore here within Puget Sound, but very similar in location to that one. So I said it was a magnitude 4.5, and it did very little structural damage. Most of the damage was sort of interior kinds of things falling off of shelves. I live down in this area, so I wasn't right next to it, but in fact we felt it, and part of that is related to the type of material that our home is built on. As I said, it's this loose material from river deposits and mud flows, and it really shakes. This is just a map that shows from the 65 earthquake the intensity it was felt in different areas. So there's maximum intensity down here, the epicenter again down by Olympia, sort of between Seattle and Tacoma, and here is a 7. But you can see that people actually felt it out beyond that. If we were to look in greater detail here, though, we would see that areas of loose sediments experience more shaking. And if any of you are at all familiar with the San Francisco earthquake history of the 1906 quake, homes were left standing that were up on the tall knobs of solid rock in San Francisco. And those that were down and looser sediments were the ones that were destroyed in that earthquake. Those that were destroyed were basically not bulldozed in 1906, but their debris was all pushed in and filled in other areas. And the I just realized that it's escaped my mind, but on the north side of San Francisco, facing San Francisco Bay, called the Mission District, was all built on fill from the 1906 earthquake. And where was the great damage from the 1989 earthquake? Right there, because it was loose fill material. So we have the same kind of problem associated with here. Well, what does this mean for us? I guess one of the things that it means is that we simply need to be aware of these hazards. I don't see it as trying to cast some great big black cloud over people who live in areas of risk. But on the other hand, we certainly need to be prepared and need to think further ahead in terms of the kinds of reactions that we would have. This kind of a diagram has been done for the entire U.S., and I'm just going to sneak back here to the slide projector and just show the areas of risk throughout the United States. Areas that are deemed as being sort of highest risk throughout the United States. So those of you who don't live right here in the north, in the area of the North Cascades, can see sort of the risk globally. And certainly California is one which has the major area of risk, but we can see that we're in an area that's sort of highlighted as being the same potential, perhaps not frequency, but certainly in magnitude. The New Madrid earthquake area, one of the largest earthquakes that's occurred in the lower 48 states, occurred around Charleston, South Carolina. Not a very easy one to explain with plate tectonics, and also one in the Boston area in the 1700s. Well, I'm going to turn lights on. And I know we need to wrap up because we all have the same destination at 6 o'clock. But do people have any questions? Anybody here from California?
What you say that we should spend more money on earthquake preparedness, in what way?
A large proportion in terms of I think educating the population about the kinds of things that are a potential risk and the kinds of things that individually each of us can do. There are some very, very simple things to do, such as making sure that your hot water heater, particularly if it's gas powered, but isn't freestanding, but is secured to an adjacent wall. Simply keeping a store of fresh water on hand, because certainly our water systems are all going to be dysfunctional. Teaching kids about, you know, what they should do. Teaching adults about what they should do.
It seems to me that would not require a great deal of money.
No. And then the next level is to prepare communities for reaction to disasters. And
building codes have changed.
Yeah, building codes have been changed.
There's an interesting article in Sunset, I think, within the past 2 years, showing, subsequent to one of the California quakes, how homeowners are being advised to secure their building, put more anchoring bolts and so forth on it.
Well,
very interesting article.
Even simple things, you know, if you have a beautiful china cabinet, bolt it to the wall, or run a bolt through the back so that it doesn't fall over, or put those little child catches
on drawers,
on the cupboards and drawers and things like that. A few dollars spent like that can save somebody a zillion dollars in broken crockery and...
Right, and you're right that that's not a large amount of money. The large amount of money needs to get communities ready for disasters, to train personnel to react to them, and to have the supplies on hand to be able to respond and to sustain a community. And Washington has really not paid much attention to that at all.
But your preparedness figure must not include the money that the highway divisions put out to retrofit their bridges and all this kind of stuff, which amounts to millions of dollars.
No, it doesn't. No, you're right. But unfortunately, I'm not sure we've retrofitted them enough. I mean, people who I live around keep talking about, well, yeah, we have a big earthquake, we won't be able to get out of here, will we? I mean, just simple highway overpasses. But one of the other things that Evelyn mentioned is earthquake insurance. And homeowners in California would never dream of owning without earthquake insurance, basically, at this time. And yet,
now, are your rates in Washington in recognition of the potential?
Yeah, and in fact, after the January earthquake, they wouldn't even insure, they wouldn't even add the riders for earthquake for 60 days. Because of that. Yeah. But for example, the Loma Prieta quake, I don't know how many of you remember pictures of that, but whole homes shifted off their foundations. You know, if we think about it, structurally, our houses aren't particularly well attached to the foundations. And a lot of insurance companies will not insure homes that are built like that without the homeowner having had that additional structural reinforcement to make sure that that was reduced. I mean, I lived in South Florida during a few years, and, you know, hurricanes were the thing there. But they hadn't had a big hurricane near Miami in almost 15 years when Hurricane David went through the Dominican Republic and went... and then came toward Miami. And, I mean, people just kind of ran around, well, what do I do? I mean, because they hadn't been practicing it. So.
Well, that's the same with the schools. I think the schools should practice. And then there should also be some stations where children could maybe call home.
Well, of course, phone systems aren't going to be working either.
That's another thing. They have to figure out a plan. That's but one of the stupid things is that school system, while they're training the children how to deal with earthquakes, are building new schools right on fault lines that are ready to go right at the junction of the two, one of the two, well, San Andreas and one of the other major faults in Southern California, in the Tehachapi. They're busy building a new high school right smack in that area, and they've done it before many times in other areas.
It's quite interesting to look at the distribution of schools in California. I mean, there's a lot of faults in California, but the proportion of schools on faults is higher than the proportion of this state, which has faults through it.
And so many of the areas that are faults are very useful for highways because there's a valley there. There's a separation, of course, in the fault line and the fault zone. And so they build all the roads on faults, most of them, lots of them. Yep. You can follow San Andreas Fault all the way from southern, southeastern California all the way across, almost down the road, all the way up to Point Reyes, which is in the Bay Area.
That's right.
And even the Center for the Emergency Response in California is on an earthquake
Well, they'll know when it happens, won't they?
Is there no geological explanation for the potential to Salt Lake and at New Madrid?
There are ancient geologic features which seem to be reactivated, particularly in the New Madrid area. Faults that are about 400 million years old, which somehow the strain is still accumulating through time and released as earthquakes.
Related in any way to plate tectonics?
Not to today's pattern of plate tectonics, but to that of the arrangement of the plates hundreds of millions of years ago. but probably just related to other natural processes. I mean, you know, river shifting and water that is making its way down through the crust and lubricating faults and just very, very less obvious kinds of geologic processes that would result in it.
Is there any correlation between the hot springs that we find in a certain area?
Certainly hot springs tend to be distributed near areas of volcanic activity because it's hot molten material which are making their way up to the surface. Now some of that is also found associated with faults because faults are this plane along which the crust is moving and it gives sort of a nice avenue for the hotter material to travel to the surface, hot water and so on. I know that people are probably antsy. I want to thank you all for coming.
Thank you. And
I'm more than welcome to answer questions individually.